9. The Gorillas. The weather had warmed again after the first snow. There was sun, a little rain, northwest wind, light frost at night, much as it had been all the last moon phase of autumn. Winter was not so different from what went before. It was a bit hard to believe the records of previous years that told of 10-foot snowfalls and whole moon phases when the ice never thawed. Maybe that came later. The problem now was the gaol. Paying very little attention to Agat's gorillas, though he had inflicted some nasty wounds on their army's flanks, the northerners had poured at a fast march down through Ascatavar Range and camped east of the forest, and now on the third day were assaulting the winter city. They were not destroying it, however. They were obviously trying to save the granaries from the fire, and the herds, and perhaps the women. It was only the men they slaughtered. Perhaps, as reported, they were going to try to garrison the place with a few of their own men. Come spring, the Gaul, returning from the south, could march from town to town of an empire. It was not like the Hilfs, Agat thought as he lay hidden under an immense fallen tree, waiting for his little army to take their positions for their own assault on Tavar. He had been in the open, fighting and hiding 2 days and nights now. A cracked rib from the beating he had taken in the woods, though well bound up, hurt. And so did a shallow scalp wound from a Gaul slingshot yesterday. But with immunity to infection, wounds healed very fast, and Agat paid scant attention to anything less than a severed artery. Only a concussion had got him down at all. He was thirsty at this moment and a bit stiff, but his mind was pleasantly alert as he got this brief and forced rest. It wasn't like the Hilfs, this planning ahead. Hilfs did not consider either time or space in the linear imperialistic fashion of his own species. Time to them was a lantern lighting a step before, a step behind. The rest was indistinguishable dark. Time was this day, this one day of the immense year. They had no historical vocabulary. There was merely today and time past. They looked ahead only to the next season at most. They did not look down over time, but were in it as the lamp in the night, as the heart in the body. And so also with space. Space to them was not a surface on which to draw boundaries, but a range, a heartland centered on the self and clan and tribe. Around the range were areas that brightened as one approached them and dimmed as one departed, the farther, the fainter. But there were no lines, no limits. This planning ahead, this trying to keep hold of a conquered place across both space and time was untypical. It showed what? An autonomous change in a Hilf culture pattern? Or an infection from the old northern colonies and forays of man? It would be the first time, Agat thought sardonically, that they ever learned an idea from us. Next, we'll be catching their colds. And that'll kill us off. And our ideas might well kill them off. There was in him a deep and mostly unconscious bitterness against the Tavarans who had smashed his head and ribs and broken their covenant, and whom he must now watch getting slaughtered in their stupid little mud city under his eyes. He had been helpless to fight against them. Now he was almost helpless to fight for them. He detested them for forcing helplessness upon him. At that moment, just as Rollory was starting back towards Landon behind the herds, there was a rustle in the dry leaf dust in the hollow behind him. Before the sound had ceased, he had his loaded dart gun trained on the hollow. Explosives were forbidden by the law of cultural embargo, which had become a basic ethos of the exiles. But some native tribes, in the early years of fighting, had used poisoned spears and darts. Freed by this from taboo, the doctors of Landin had developed some effective poisons which were still in the hunting-fighting repertory. There were stunners, paralyzers, slow and quick killers. This one was lethal and took 5 seconds to convulse the nervous system of a large animal, such as a gall. The mechanism of the dart gun was neat and simple, accurate within a little over 50 meters. "Come on out," Agat called to the silent hollow, and his still swollen lips stretched out in a grin. All things considered, he was ready to kill another Hilf. "Altera?" A Hilf rose to his full height among the dead gray bushes of the hollow, his arms by his sides. It was Umaksiman. "Hell," Agat said, lowering his gun, but not all the way. Repressed violence shook him a moment with a spastic shudder. "Altera," the Tavaran said huskily, "in my father's tent we were friends. And afterwards, in the woods?" The native stood there silent, a big, heavy figure, his fair hair filthy, his face clayey with hunger and exhaustion. "I heard your voice with the others. If you had to avenge your sister's honor, you could have done it one at a time." Agat's finger was still on the trigger, but when Umaksiman answered, his expression changed. He had not hoped for an answer. "I was not with the others. I followed them and stopped them. 5 days ago, I killed Ukwet, my nephew brother, who led them. I have been in the hills since then." Agat uncocked his gun and looked away. "Come on up here," he said after a while. Only then did both of them realize that they had been standing up, talking out loud, in these hills full of Gaal scouts. Agat gave a long, noiseless laugh as Umaksiman slithered into the niche under the log with him. "Friend, enemy, what the hell," he said. "Here." He passed the Hilf a hunk of bread from his wallet. "Rolleri is my wife, since 3 days ago." Silent, Umaksiman took the bread and ate it as a hungry man eats. "When they whistle from the left over there, we're going to go in all together, heading for that breach in the walls at the north corner, and make a run through the town to pick up any Tavarans we can. The Gaal are looking for us around the bogs where we were this morning, not here. It's the only time we're going for the town. You want to come?" Umaksiman nodded. "Are you armed?" Umaksiman lifted his axe. Side by side, not speaking, they crouched watching the burning roofs, the tangles and spurts of motion in the wrecked alleys of the little town on the hill facing them. A gray sky was closing off the sunlight. Smoke was acrid on the wind. Off to their left, a whistle shrilled. The hillsides west and north of Tavar sprang alive with men, little scattered figures crouched running down into the vale and up the slope, piling over the broken wall and into the wreckage and confusion of the town. As the men of Landin met at the wall, they joined into squads of 5 to 20 men, and these squads kept together, whether in attacking groups of Gaal looters with dart guns, bolos, and knives, or in picking up whatever Tavaran women and children they found and making for the gate with them. They went so fast and sure that they might have rehearsed the raid. The Gaal, occupied in cleaning out the last resistance in the town, were taken off guard. Agat and Umaksiman kept pace, and a group of 8 or 10 coalesced with them as they ran through the stone-pounding square, then down a narrow tunnel alley to a lesser square, and burst into one of the big kin houses. One after another leapt down the earthen stairway into the dark interior. White-faced men with red plumes twined in their horn-like hair came yelling and swinging axes, defending their loot. The dart from Agat's gun shot straight into the open mouth of one. He saw Umaksiman take the arm off a Gaal's shoulder as an axeman lops a branch from a tree. Then there was silence. Women crouched in silence in the half-darkness. A baby bawled and bawled. "Come with us," Agat shouted. Some of the women moved towards him, and seeing him, stopped. Umaksiman loomed up beside him in the dim light from the doorway, heavy laden with some burden on his back. "Come, bring the children," he roared, and at the sound of his known voice they all moved. Agat got them grouped at the stairs with his men strung out to protect them, then gave the word. They broke from the kin house and made for the gate. No Gaul stopped their run. A queer bunch of women, children, men, led by Agat with a Gaul axe, running cover for Umaksiman, who carried on his shoulders a great dangling burden, the old chief, his father, Wold. They made it out the gate, ran the gauntlet of a Gaul troop in the old tenting place, and with other such flying squads of land and men and refugees in front of them and behind them, scattered into the woods. The whole run through Tavar had taken about 5 minutes. There was no safety in the forest. Gaul scouts and troops were scattered along the road to Landen. The refugees and rescuers fanned out singly and in pairs southward into the woods. Agat stayed with Umaksiman, who could not defend himself carrying the old man. They struggled through the underbrush. No enemy met them among the gray aisles and hummocks, the fallen trunks and tangled dead branches and mummied bushes. Somewhere far behind them, a woman's voice screamed and screamed. It took them a long time to work south and west in a half circle through the forest, over the ridges and back north at last to Landen. When Umaksiman could not go any farther, Wold walked, but he could only go very slowly. When they came out of the trees, at last they saw the lights of the City of Exile flaring far off in the windy dark above the sea. Half dragging the old man, they struggled along the hillside and came to the land gate. "Hilf's coming!" guards sang out before they got within clear sight, spotting Umaksiman's fair hair. Then they saw Agat, and the voices cried, "The Altera! The Altera!" They came to meet him and brought him into the city. Men who had fought beside him, taken his orders, saved his skin for these 3 days of guerrilla fighting in the woods and hills. They had done what they could, 400 of them against an enemy that swarmed like the vast migrations of the beasts. 15,000 men, Agat had guessed. 15,000 warriors, between 60 or 70,000 Gaul in all, with their tents and cookpots and travois and han and fur rugs and axes and armlets and cradle boards and tinderboxes, all their scant belongings, and their fear of the winter, and their hunger. He had seen Gaul women in their encampments gathering the dead lichen off logs and eating it. It did not seem probable that the little City of Exile still stood, untouched by this flood of violence and hunger, with torches alight above its gates of iron and carved wood, and men to welcome him home. Trying to tell the story of the last 3 days, he said, "We came around behind their line of march yesterday afternoon." The words had no reality, neither had this warm room, the faces of men and women he had known all his life, listening to him. The ground behind them, where the whole migration had come down some of the narrow valleys, it looked like the ground after a landslide. Raw dirt. Nothing. Everything trodden to dust, to nothing. "How can they keep going? What do they eat?" Huru muttered. "The winter's stores in the cities they take. The land's all stripped by now. The crops are in, the big game gone south. They must loot every town on their course and live off the Han herds or starve before they get out of the snowlands." "Then they'll come here," one of the Alterans said quietly. "I think so. Tomorrow or the next day." This was true, but it was not real either. He passed his hand over his face, feeling the dirt and stiffness and the unhealed soreness of his lips. He had felt he must come make his report to the government of his city, but now he was so tired that he could not say anything more and did not hear what they were saying. He turned to Rollery, who knelt in silence beside him. Not raising her amber eyes, she said very softly, "You should go home, Altera." He had not thought of her all those endless hours of fighting and running and shooting and hiding in the woods. He had known her for 2 weeks, had talked with her at any length perhaps 3 times, had lain with her once, had taken her as his wife in the Hall of Law in the early morning 3 days ago, and an hour later had left to go with the guerrillas. He knew nothing much about her, and she was not even of his species, and in a couple of days more they would probably both be dead. He gave his noiseless laugh and put his hand gently on hers. "Yes, take me home," he said. Silent, delicate, alien, she rose and waited for him as he took his leave of the others. He had told her that Wold and Amoximan, with about 200 more of her people, had escaped or been rescued from the violated Winter City and were now in refugee quarters in Landon. She had not asked to go to them. As they went up the steep street together from Allah's house to his, she asked, "Why did you enter Tavar to save the people?" "Why?" It seemed a strange question to him. "Because they wouldn't save themselves." "That's no reason, Altera." She seemed submissive, the shy native wife who did her lord's will. Actually, he was learning, she was stubborn, willful, and very proud. She spoke softly but said exactly what she meant. "It is a reason, Rollery. You can't just sit there watching the bastards kill off people slowly. Anyhow, I want to fight. To fight back."
"But your town? How do you feed these people you brought here? If the Gaul lay siege, or afterwards, in winter?"
"We have enough. Food's not our worry. All we need is men." He stumbled a little from weariness, but the clear, cold night had cleared his mind, and he felt the rising of a small spring of joy that he had not felt for a long time. He had some sense that this little relief, this lightness of spirit, was given him by her presence. He had been responsible for everything so long. She, the stranger, the foreigner, of alien blood and mind, did not share his power or his conscience or his knowledge or his exile. She shared nothing at all with him, but had met him and joined with him wholly and immediately across the gulf of their great difference. As if it were that difference, the alienness between them, that let them meet, and that in joining them together, freed them. They entered his unlocked front door. No light burned in the high, narrow house of roughly dressed stone. It had stood here for 3 years, 180 moon phases. His great-grandfather had been born in it, and his grandfather, and his father, and himself. It was as familiar to him as his own body. To enter it with her, the nomad woman whose only home would have been this tent or that, on one hillside or another, or the teeming burrows under the snow, gave him a peculiar pleasure. He felt a tenderness towards her, which he hardly knew how to express. Without intent, he said her name not aloud but paraverbally. At once she turned to him in the darkness of the hall. In the darkness she looked into his face. The house and city were silent around them. In his mind he heard her say his own name, like a whisper in the night, like a touch across the abyss. "You bespoke me," he said aloud, unnerved, marveling. She said nothing, but once more he heard in his mind, along his blood and nerves, her mind that reached out to him. "Agat. Agat."